what is Israel supposed to do? That's what I want. I want people to ask this question. And the question is, for those who say we should have a ceasefire, again, wouldn't it be great? You could have a ceasefire tomorrow. All it needs to happen is Hamas needs to give up. Then all this ends. But, you know, they don't want to do that. And so sadly, you know, a lot of innocent people that don't deserve to die are dying.
That's former U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Tom Nides, saying Israel must move forward with its campaign to eliminate Hamas. I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast.
Hi, everyone. It's Tom Nides here. I'm so honored that President Biden selected me to serve in this beautiful country. The bonds between our two countries, as President Biden has said, are unbreakable.
Tom Nides worked in the Clinton and Obama administrations and at Morgan Stanley before being nominated as President Biden's first ambassador to Israel in 2021.
It's really important for people to understand you can be the American ambassador to Israel and care deeply about the fate of the Palestinian people.
He left the post in July, but since the Hamas attack on October 7th, he has directed his energy to assisting Israel and the U.S.-Israel relationship as a private citizen.
Listen, this is important to the state of Israel. It's important to peace in the Middle East. And quite frankly, it's very important to the Palestinian people.
As Israel's military campaign draws growing international attention, and as civilian casualties rise in Gaza, Nides assesses Israel's diplomatic and humanitarian challenges.
Do you think Israel is doing as much as it can to prevent civilian casualties?
Yeah, I do. I'm not making excuses. This is a war.
I also asked him whether the Biden administration's past policies towards Iran, including its attempt to revive the nuclear deal, sent the wrong signal to Hamas's financial backer. But Nides insists that now, the U.S. is delivering a clear and strong message of deterrence.
Iran will have to make that decision, how far they want to push this president, and they'll have to live with the consequences of those decisions.
Ambassador Tom Nides, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you for having me.
Israel and Hamas have now been at war for more than a month, since Hamas's terrorist attack against Israel on October 7th. You have said the next 30 days are the most important in Israel's history. Why?
Because Israel is trying to do four things at the same time, and they all contradict each other.
What are they?
One is they're trying to rid the country of Hamas. Hamas needs to be gone. And that's complicated and difficult. And it's something they have to do. They have no choice. It's a deterrent. They need to do it. They need to send a message. The brutality of what Hamas did to Israel needs to be forever wiped from people's memories, and Hamas needs to go. Second, they need to get these hostages out. There's 240 hostages who are in the tunnels. They're probably spread around Gaza City. So obviously that runs in contradiction to getting rid of Hamas because it's complicated, obviously. Third, they got to keep Hezbollah out. They've got to keep the North safe. And obviously that's complicated as well. And lastly, and very importantly, they've got to do everything they can to prevent loss of Palestinian lives. Because none of us like seeing the pictures of children being killed. These are innocent kids. They're innocent people. Hamas doesn't care about the Palestinian people. Let's make clear. They want to use them as human shields. They don't want them to leave the North. They want to let them sit and be in the places where if Israel ultimately does things, they want more, as they said it, they want more martyrs. They want more Palestinian deaths. It served their purpose, and their purpose is to destroy the state of Israel. And so that is the complication for the state of Israel. They have these four things all going on at the same time, all attempting to try to resolve, and it's a huge challenge.
Why does it hinge on the next 30 days?
Well, because I think ultimately, as you know, these things all have momentums to them, right? They have a rhythm. And clearly, Israel understands, first of all, the hostages themselves. History will show, you know, if you're going to get these hostages released, quicker the better. Obviously, Hezbollah getting in. You know, I think there's some view that because of deterrence the United States has put in place with the big ships in the Mediterranean, that unlikely they'll get in now since they haven't gotten in yet, but you never know. Mm-hmm. And so all the pressure, and let's be clear, the international pressure on Israel is getting greater and greater, including, you know, pressure on the United States. And so far, the Biden administration is steadfast on the support of the state of Israel and the need to get rid of Hamas. But you've been around this as I have. As this goes on, people's attention goes other places and pressure builds.
you were the U.S. ambassador to Israel until July when you returned home to the United States. You returned to the private sector. After 10/7, you resigned from a new role at Wells Fargo after a month on the job to focus full-time on the situation in the Middle East. You said in your resignation announcement to your colleagues, quote, "Watching the horrific events unfold in Israel and Gaza had a profound effect on me in ways I could not have imagined." How did the events of 10/7 impact you?
Well, I had a lot of friends there who have lost kids at that concert. You know, I've had friends of mine who's, a buddy of mine's daughter was kidnapped. Just put it this way, assume for a minute that 350 million Americans, or the number of Americans, had a family member who died in the Twin Towers, God forbid. This is what Israel is going through. Every call I have every day, every single day, I talk to 10, 15 people in Israel. I mean, from the government officials to my friends, to my neighbors, and they're just suffering in a way that it's remarkable. Hamas did something that has not occurred in Israel's 75-year history. They brought the country together. The country is together, and they want to rid Israel of the threat of Hamas, and they want these hostages back. So I don't want to make a big deal of me spending time. There's a lot of people that are volunteering and helping out. I mean, all across the world, people are working to try to help now Israel get through this, but also work on the humanitarian crisis that Hamas has created. So I'm doing a little bit of my share. Obviously, I care deeply about it. They're my friends. But listen, this is important to the state of Israel. It's important to peace in the Middle East. And quite frankly, it's very important to the Palestinian people. If we're ever going to come out of this with some sort of, new Middle East, we got to make sure everyone's hands are on deck.
Where are you focusing your energies primarily?
Well, as you know, as I mentioned, I spent a lot of time with the hostages. I've tried to do that. I've spent a little time with all the agencies that are working on this, from the UGA to all the hospital stuff. I've helped. I'm talking to a lot of people. I talk to the White House a lot. I've been trying to do a little media just because, again, I think it's important for people like me who have experienced in this, and also put this in context, because it's not simple, and people don't understand it. And you see what's going on college campuses. I like to tell people you can be pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian people, which is what I am. When I was there in Israel, I think, half my time I spent working on the Palestinian issues for healthcare and education, opportunities for those Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza. It's really important. And for people to understand, you can be the American ambassador to Israel and care deeply about the fate of the Palestinian people. And so that's, if I can do just a little bit, I don't want to get carried away about my importance or anyone individually, but collectively, we all got to work together.
You've spoken to the families of several hostages.
Mm-hmm.
Some Israeli relatives of hostages are calling on Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister, to make concessions, such as release all of the Palestinian prisoners held in Israel to Hamas in order to bring their family members home. Is that a non-starter?
I'm not going to offer or suggest what should be done or not be done. Clearly, the United States, Israel, the Qataris, the Egyptians, the Emiratis, everyone is working for the same goal. They want to get Hamas to release these innocent mothers and daughters and babies. I mean, who does such things? It's barbaric as this, okay? And they knew exactly what they were doing. They knew exactly Hamas did what they did because they knew the reaction would be from Israel. And their whole goal, and if tens of thousands, if hundreds of thousands of Palestinians die because of it, their view of this is so be it. It's about martyrism. It's about building an international condemnation of Israel. And to build, hopefully, in their minds, Hamas's minds, because it's so insidious and so sick, is to build basically a war against Israel. And that's their goal. And so, these poor people, this 240, they were, by the way, most of these people were sitting at a concert, a peacenik concert. People hear about this concert. The kids that went there were doing it purposely right by the Gaza border to show that there's peace between Israel and Palestinians. These were not These were not military guys. These weren't people trying to cause trouble. They weren't people trying to make mischief. They were just trying to have fun. And they wake up, next thing they know, they're either killed or grabbed and stuck on the back of a motorcycle or whatever, and now living in a tunnel somewhere. So I'm not smart enough to tell you exactly how. I know for sure, because I talk to the White House every day, multiple times a day, they're working on this to free these hostages, to get them back to their loved ones.
How do you rate the odds?
You can only be hopeful, you know? I mean, you're dealing with terrorists, okay? You're dealing with terrorists. And when we deal with terrorists, they do terrible things.
This week, Israeli forces have separated northern Gaza from the rest of the territory. They've encircled Gaza City. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinian civilians remain in the north. Hamas is likely to continue to use them as human shields as the fighting intensifies. What are you hearing from your friends, your colleagues, your contacts on the ground in Israel and in Gaza that isn't penetrating our American news coverage?
Well, very similar to what we just said. Israel has attempted to get as many Gazans out of the north as humanly possible, right? To get them, they've had pauses to allow them to leave. There's no question that Hamas has attempted to keep as many people in northern Gaza as possible because they understand it, that they're human shields. And again, I go back to this. They don't care about how many lives get lost, the Palestinian lives, because if they did, they would just give up the hostages. Or if they did, they would just give up. But they're not giving up because this is about martyrism. So the reality of this is that what people don't understand, this is a war, to be clear, and there are innocent people getting killed. Absolutely. Innocent people that got killed in Israel and now innocent people that are getting killed in Gaza. And it's horrifying. But we all need to remember how we got here, why this happened and how we got there. So ultimately, you know, Israel has to do as much as they possibly can to basically minimize the loss of civilian lives, because these Palestinians don't deserve this. The Hamas needs to be dead. But the Palestinian people that are living in Gaza, regardless of they, you know, where they live in northern Gaza, so they don't deserve this. We need to get those humanitarian corridors open. They need to get the food, the fuel, the hospitals going, and all the things they need to do to make sure fewer, you know, Palestinians die. They've already been a huge number. They've already been dead or have already died. We have to do what we can.
In your estimation, do you think Israel is doing as much as it can to prevent civilian casualties?
Yeah, I do. I'm not making excuses. This is a war. So I can't say, oh, yes, you know, yes, they're doing everything possible. No, this is a war, folks. And again, as someone who cares deeply, I got off the phone and, you know, an hour ago with a friend of mine who lives in Ramallah, has a lot of family and friends in Gaza. You know, he's like, I'm in tears with me on the phone. I mean, and he said, you got to get this stopped. So I don't.
So he's a Palestinian.
He's a Palestinian, a very successful businessman, has a large operation in Gaza and in the West Bank. So are they doing everything they can? You know, I hope they are. But this is a war. This is a bunch of terrorists who are attempting, you know, what is Israel supposed to do? That's what I want. I want people to ask this question. And the question is, to those who say we should have a ceasefire, again, wouldn't it be great? You could have a ceasefire tomorrow. All it needs to happen is Hamas needs to give up. Just give up the victims, those who kidnapped, get out of the tunnels, get on a boat and go somewhere. Then all this ends. But, you know, they don't want to do that. And so sadly, you know, a lot of innocent people that don't deserve to die are dying.
According to Axios, the Biden administration's urging Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu to take a 3-day pause in the fighting to secure the release of 10 to 15 hostages. How can, in the context of negotiating with Hamas, how can one be certain that this terrorist organization will follow through on any promises it makes about releasing hostages?
Can't. You have to basically, you know, you have to just basically, when you're talking about, listen, if you were, God forbid, if you were the parent or the mother or the father, the grandparent of someone who has been kidnapped, you want the Americans to do whatever they can to get your loved one back. And if the Biden administration can offer up a suggestion, which is a pause of 2 day or 1 day to get 15 people's lives out, we should try it. Again, I'm not on the ground doing the negotiations, but you know, every one of these lives are important. They're not only just American lives, they're Israeli lives, they're across the board international community. So can you trust Hamas? Of course not. Can you trust? Absolutely not. But you know, if the Qataris are working on this, if the Qataris say, listen, we believe we can get some of these out, this is what we need, then you have to use that channel. That's what hostage, you know, negotiations are, to see if you can get some of them out. But I don't trust them.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has suggested he's open to the idea of little pauses. 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours here. He's completely against any longer kind of pause until what he says is all hostages are released, including military hostages, because it gives Hamas a chance to regroup and reorganize. Is there any prospect for a diplomatic solution?
I don't know. I know for certain Israel will do what it needs to do to get rid of Hamas. Will Hamas wake up to realize that the gig is up? Maybe. But these are martyrs, so I don't know. They're not rational people. These are not rational human beings when your only goal is to destroy the state of Israel. It would be different if this group of people was sitting around and talking about the need for a two-state solution. Or, oh my God, wouldn't it be great if we got better health care for Palestinians living in Gaza? Now, you know, they won't even share the food that is stored in the bunkers in Gaza City with the people that need it, because they believe that the military, the resistance is more important than the lives of the Palestinians. This is what we're dealing with. So you know, is there a solution? Listen, people are going to work on it. You can never give up hope. You have to do both at the same time. You have to take military operations and have conversations and hope between the two something happens. And I think that's the best we can do and best we can hope for.
So you mentioned the increasing condemnation internationally against Israel from many countries around the world related to civilian casualties in Gaza as one of the places where Israel's racing against the clock. I think the seminal question, right, is since Hamas is willfully placing residents of Gaza in danger, directly in harm's way to protect themselves, how does Israel think about balancing its goal of eliminating Hamas with its desire to protect as many civilians as possible?
God, it's hard. And that's what I said at the beginning of when we asked at the beginning. I said they're trying to do all these things at the same time, and they all run in contradiction with each other, right? You want to rid Hamas, but you want to kill innocent people. You want to keep Hezbollah out, but you want to kill Hamas. You basically, you know, you want to get the hostages out, but you need to kill Hamas. The problem here, there's a lot of contradictions. And Israel knows they're fighting against the clock. They understand. They're not stupid. I was there multiple times during my 2 years as ambassador where rockets would go from Gaza, either sent by PIDGE or by Hamas. This would go on for 4 or 5 days. Israel would retaliate. They'd do a lot of bombing. And then the international community would say, stop, pause, stop the bombardment. And Israel would feel the pressure to do so. This is different than that. But there is no question that Israel can't do this forever. And it's not going to be able to do it forever. They can do what they need to do is what, and I think the advice that the administration is giving, although I'm not obviously in the situation room right now, but I am what I believe to be the case, they're saying to the Israelis, lessen the tempo on the air bombardments and do what you need to do on the ground. Because obviously when you're going with airplanes and dropping bombs, you are going to kill more people. That's just what is going to happen, given the fact, as you've just said, Hamas puts their facilities purposely inside hospitals, apartment buildings, because they know exactly what they're going to do. Israel's going to drop a bomb to get them, and they're going to kill a bunch of innocent people. They know this. This is 101 terrorism, and they don't give a crap about whatever Palestinian lives are lost. They're like, it's martyrism. It's better for the overall cause. Tell those people who are sitting in southern Gaza, living in tents now, you know, not having food, lost their apartment, lost their family, lost their kids, that this is a better, ask them, do they feel good about the cause? Do they feel good about the support of Hamas? I don't think so. And I think it's pretty sick. And again, to be clear, I'll debate the issue around the Palestinian issue all day long because I fundamentally believe we need a two-state solution. We need better, you know, more people working on the issue around the Palestinian issue. I fundamentally, in my core, believe it is important. This is not the way to get it because guess what? Hamas doesn't care about any of that.
How you know Israel's leadership personally and well because you've been the recent ambassador, you're the most recent American ambassador to Israel. How do you reflect on the coalition wartime cabinet of Benny Gantz and Bibi Netanyahu and others?
Well,
how they're dealing with all these contradictions?
So they're all my friends. I mean, put the prime minister aside. Benny Gantz in particular is someone I have an enormous amount of respect for. I mean, what I'm happy about is some of the right-wing lunatics, that's a diplomatic term, by the way, are not inside the war cabinet. I mean, you have ideologues who care about the ideology and not care about the issues that are bigger for the whole country. And the good news is that Netanyahu figured that out and he created a war cabinet, and the war cabinet's a small subset of his cabinet, including Benny Gantz, who came in from outside the government to support the prime minister and with a few other people that he's together. So I feel comfortable with Benny Gantz and Defense Minister Gallant, who is the defense minister, working collectively with others, that they're going to try to do the right thing. I say this, the pressure on this government to get Hamas is beyond anything I've ever seen in my life. You know, all my liberal friends, and I have a lot of liberal friends in Israel, they're as angry and committed than the right. I mean, Hamas brought the country together in a way I've never seen before. So there's enormous political pressure to get the hostages free, to rid Israel of the threat of Hamas. And that pressure is building, obviously, in this war cabinet. At least has some cooler heads are in the cabinet and will work in a very strategic way, in my opinion.
You were in Israel during a highly divisive time politically. I mean, you reflect on how 10/7 has brought the country together, but you were there at a time where it was decisively polarized. Prime Minister Netanyahu had to endure massive domestic protests for many, many months related to his efforts to purportedly reform the judiciary. Others would say undermine the independence of the judiciary. What did you observe about Israeli politics in the time you were there?
Well, it's interesting. It's very funny. I was commenting to someone very, very senior in the Israeli government this morning. And one of the ministers, when I was taking on this whole judicial reform, because the president of the United States and I, as his mouthpiece, were saying, slow down, try to build consensus on judicial reform, don't divide the country. And one of these ministers, this guy named Shikli, who's the diaspora minister, attacked me and said, you should mind your own business. You, America, should mind your own business. And my response was, you really want America to mind their own business? Really? And given the current events, I wanted to call the minister Shikli and ask, do you really want the United States to mind their own business in this current environment? So I think it is, I think that what happened to the government was, the prime minister, again, I have a lot of respect for Netanyahu. I have my differences with him and certainly politically, but, he had a coalition he put together. Netanyahu was the most liberal guy in his government. He basically put a coalition together with some people who ideologically were way farther right than he was, but forced him to do many things that I'm not sure left to his own, he would necessarily been. This wouldn't have been the first thing on his list. When I sat down with Netanyahu, he said the two things he cared about was Iran and normalizing with Saudi Arabia. Those are the two things that Netanyahu, and I kept saying to him, Mr. Prime Minister, I believe you. Why are you being distracted by all this noise? And I think ultimately it became, a byproduct of politics. You know, I think the politics drove him in some respects. If he wanted to keep his coalition together, he had to do things such as judicial reform, which I felt was not only a waste of time and energy, even though you could argue that the judicial could be used reform, our judicial system could be reformed, obviously, but it was totally distracting at a time where his biggest goals were the threat of Iran, which proven to be correct because Hamas is a complete byproduct of Iran. And we were so close to the Saudi Arabia piece. It's, you know, and I think, again, we'll talk about that, I'm sure, in a second, because I do think that that can be brought back in a real way and will have a huge impact. But I just used to say to the Prime Minister, why are you spending time on this when there's so many more important things that the country can do? And I think that's I'm sure the Prime Minister, beyond this, beyond the intelligence failure that occurred and how this all happened, I think he would step back and think in multiple years, he'll look back and believe that the distraction of the judicial reform, I don't believe it caused the October 7th, but he just wasted a lot of time on things that he could have been pushing his agenda that could have moved the country forward.
Do you think it's fair to question whether his focus on divisive domestic politics somehow impacted the outcome of 10-7?
You know, I've thought about that. You know, the good news about Jews, I being one of them, you know, we're all good into self-reflection, okay? There's going to be a lot of self-reflection.
You're good at it on a countrywide level.
Yeah, like we all like think, you know, I always like think about my decisions I've made and, you know, do a lot of self-reflection. It's in my DNA. I assure you one thing. I just finished the Golda movie. Yeah, last night I watched
night. We had leave on this program.
Yeah, and I watched it and they had a commission set up and they and they really examined. This is going to make that commission look like a walk in the park because the country has gone through something they never, ever, ever thought would happen. And they will look at this question around, was the government distracted by judicial reform?
Not only was it distracted, but did it give Hamas the impression that Israel was weak?
You know, I don't know. No one should question Israel's strength. I mean, I think this was, if I was writing the essay of how this happened, I think what happened here was generally a view that Hamas had too much to lose and they would never do something like this. I think that was the fundamental philosophy, which I had many time conversations with Israeli security officials, which is, you know, yeah, they're a problem, but you know what? They're not going to go this far because they like the, you know, 15,000 Gazans were going every day into Tel Aviv and Jerusalem to work. Yeah. You know, they're getting money from Qatar through Egypt. And so I think the view was, because they know what the reaction was going to be. To do something like this, they would have known what the reaction is. That was a miscalculation. So I think ultimately they'll have to look at all of the things that happened here and why it happened. But at the end of the day, I think what will become clear is there was a point of view within the government, and that point of view was wrong.
Peggy Noonan, a conservative columnist for the Wall Street Journal.
I've heard of her.
Wrote this week that Netanyahu is the wrong leader for this crucial moment. She said his actions smeared Israel in the eyes of the world as increasingly undemocratic. He has been aggressively deaf to the rights of the Palestinian people. The U.S. in its support of Israel is tied to this discredited man in a way that doesn't help. It is a mistake for Israel, for its Knesset, to allow him to continue. What's your reaction?
I'll let Peggy speak for herself. Here's one thing I learned in Israel. Israelis will react. They'll make the decision.
Will they make it during wartime?
They shouldn't really. I mean, this
they should. But no, keep they should. The war
no, happening. I think ultimately. Ultimately, listen, this is a country that had 200,000 and 300,000 people, okay? That would be like 6 or 7 million Americans showing up every day, okay, in peacefully. No rocks or windows, no one got hurt. You know, they showed up every Saturday. I think they wouldn't let me go because they thought it was inappropriate for the American ambassador to go to a protest. But nonetheless, this country, I have enormous confidence in this country to decide who their leadership should be. And the only thing I would disagree with Peggy the president, Joe Biden's, is doing this for the state of Israel. He's not doing this for Bibi Netanyahu. Joe Biden is doing this because he believes in the importance of the state of Israel and the security of the state of Israel. And, you know, one of the benefits of Biden being so old is he gets it. He's been around this. He knows it's in his kishkas. He understands this. When he got off that airplane, when I met him in July of last year on his visit, on his 10th visit, he got off the plane at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, walked down the stairs of Air Force One, went onto the podium and looked into the camera and said, "Let me be clear, you do not need to be a Jew to be a Zionist." And he means it. It isn't like some made up nonsense BS crap you hear from politicians. The guy really, really cares about the security of state of Israel. And BB, no BB, it's irrelevant. It's about the Israeli people. It's about the security of the state of Israel. And that's exceptionally important. And to be clear, security for America. You know, Hamas is not only a threat to Israel, but it's also a threat to the United States and our interests in the region because it's a proxy for Iran. So it's important for people to understand it's not just about Israel, it's about the United States' security and the importance of our men and women who are in the region to make sure they're secure as well.
Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's leader, said in a closely watched speech recently that for now, Hezbollah will not get directly involved in the conflict in Gaza. The spread of the war into a wider regional conflict seems precariously paused at the moment. How did you interpret that speech, and how do you evaluate the probability of the conflict expanding more broadly?
It's a good question. I don't think any of us really know. I think they're making a calculation. The Iranians are making this calculation. They have several proxies in the region, but their two biggest proxies, Hamas and Hezbollah. Yes, they have the Houthis and a variety of other offshoots of different PIDG and a bunch of other offshoots, but the big ones are Hamas and Hezbollah. They know for a fact that Hamas will be disrupted and probably completely destroyed. They have another one being Hezbollah, and I think they believe, rightfully, the Israelis and with the American help will make sure that they are not attacking the state of Israel. And so I think when Joe Biden says all these comments about superpowers don't bluff, I think they believe it. I think in this particular case, they believe that Joe Biden is not going to let them screw around with Israel. And you have these ships in the Mediterranean, and this is serious. So I think they're making a calculation that was it worth it? And I think they'll do enough of these rockets once in a while every day just to keep things interesting. But again, none of us know for sure.
Yeah.
But I do think deterrence is important. I think the President of the United States made a very clear message to the regional players, stay out of this. Mm-hmm. For the time being, it's worked. We'll see how it all plays out.
The Biden administration this week deployed a guided missile submarine to the Middle East, which joins, as you mentioned, two carrier strike groups and thousands of service members that are in the region. What else can be done for deterrence?
Well, there's a lot of things going on that I'm sure you and I'd have to shoot you if I told you. But there's a lot.
Your security clearances are still
high. Yeah. I think there's a lot of stuff going on. First, behind the scenes with our allies. Listen, diplomacy matters here too, to some extent. Sending messages through the Qataris, through the Saudis. You know, there's a reason why Secretary Blinken went to Iraq. There's a lot of messages being directed here. Diplomacy matters. Listen,
a surprise visit to Iraq.
Yes, Secretary Blinken has done a spectacular job of being tough when he needs to be tough, compassionate when he needs to be compassionate, and very focused when he needs to be focused. And his personal involvement, given the fact he's so close to the president and he is a proxy for the president, has really served us well in the region. Listen, as you know, these Middle East leaders want to see us. They want us to be in the region. They want to have conversations. Listen, be clear, none of these leaders want Hamas. They want them gone too. So it's not like any of them are sitting around saying, wouldn't it be grand to keep Hamas? So there's a direct, clear, and by the way, and most of these leaders hate Iran as much as we do. So the reality of this is your common enemy is your friend. So ultimately, diplomacy is important, deterrence is important, military strength is important, rhetoric is important. I think we're trying to do all of it right now, and we'll see how it all plays out.
How would you grade our deterrence at the moment?
Very strong. I'm surprised. at how aggressive the administration has been. And I mean, I knew that in my heart, but you know what happens. You know, people are like, well, do you really need this? And listen, the president, again, I go back to this. I spent, you know, when I left, I spent about, you know, a bunch of time with the president, just the two of us, and I had this conversation with him. Not only does he know a lot about the region, he's been through the fights in the region, he's had the relationships in the region. It matters. I mean, as you know, the Middle East is a complicated beast. And having people who are experienced in this, you know, it makes me feel comfortable because you can't, one thing about Biden, you can't play him. You know, you can't like, because he's like, say, well, no, I was at that 5 years ago. You know, I did that 8 years ago. I know this game.
Yeah, he's been a player in every chapter of
foreign policy for the last three decades.
Let me then ask you, because you played an important role in the Biden administration's policy in Israel and in Iran leading up to 10/7.
Yeah.
You know that critics of the administration point to the Biden administration's interactions with the Iranian regime up till now as being interpreted as conciliatory by the regime. They point to attempts to re-enter the nuclear deal, to agreeing weeks prior to the 10/7 attack to exchange 5 American hostages for a release of funds to the Iranian regime. How do you reflect now on the posture the Biden administration had towards Iran prior to 10/7 and whether there is an opportunity or even an imperative to reevaluate that approach?
Well, first of all, I think we've been pretty consistent. I mean, I think the Biden administration has been pretty consistent. We have said, you know, we talked to the Israelis about this. You know, they're about, you know, what is your deterrence? What are you going to do for deterrence? You know, what are you going to do about degradation? They always use the 2D, degradation and deterrence. Mm-hmm. And I always say throw the third D is diplomacy. You have to have diplomacy. You have to have the third D somewhere. And I think Biden administration and Biden in particular has said, I'll do the carrot and the stick. And as you know, we did not go back into JCPOA.
That's right.
We didn't. The president himself was very clear about not going back in. Second, we did what we needed to do on sanctions. I think it's clear that we're sending a very strong message to the Iranians of every time they make a move that we basically make a move back, including what we've just done today. So I don't think there's been a total inconsistency whatsoever in the messages. And the question is going to be over the long haul, what is this relationship look like? And, you know, and I think ultimately the Biden administration has been very, very clear about this. They want to basically isolate them, attempt to try to contain them, attempt to try to make sure they don't get to break out on their nuclear program, which is what the whole JCPOA was supposed to be about. So again, I think it is at the end of the day, Iran's looking around and seeing, you know, words matter, but actions costs are more important. And he saw the actions of what this president did vis-a-vis sending those very large ships into the region pointed towards Iran. And that should send a very strong message. We're not screwing around here.
Based on your experience of having been the last ambassador to Israel over this period of time, is it your evaluation that there are not moderates in the Iranian regime with whom we can work?
You know, I don't know. I assume that they're at some point the Iranians have to make these decisions about their economy, how far they want to go to break out. Do they want to have a nuclear weapon? Do they not want to have a nuclear weapon? Do they want to go and have a military confrontation with the United States? The president's been very clear. He will not stand by and let Iran obtain a nuclear weapon. I don't think how many times this guy said this, okay? I think Joe Biden means it. And the question is, Iran will have to make that decision, how far they want to push this president, and they'll have to live with the consequences of those decisions.
Do you think his strong actions since 10/7 do more to convince Iran that he means what he said?
Yeah, hell yes. I think he's been pretty strong about this. I've been in these meetings with him on this topic. I think people, you know, like everyone misconstrues, Do you want appeasement? You know, were you supporting the JCPOA? Listen, there is no question. If Joe Biden had the opportunity, would he prefer not going to war with Iran? Yes. No kidding.
Yeah.
But do you think the American people or our allies want us to have a military conflict? No. Is there opportunities? But yes, to be clear, Biden has been very clear about this. Iran, You make the decision, you want to go to a breakout and to build a nuclear weapon, you're going to deal with the consequence of the United States of America. And I think they're seeing those actions live out in real time today as we're standing up to protect the state of Israel.
Do you think the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the fallout from the withdrawal was noticed by Iran and its proxies in the region in the same way that analysts suggest Putin also took note that the U.S. was weak?
I think what they are seeing right now is what Biden has done with rallying NATO for the first time since World War II.
Well, they're seeing it after the fact.
Okay, but, but my point is actions speak louder than words. Well, I mean, again, the
Afghans, right?
Well, but for the Joe Biden did something, quite frankly, and this is not a, I'm not making campaign speech for Joe Biden. I'm just making, this is factual, okay? The reality is for the first time since World War II, NATO is aligned and against many of their own self-interest, by the way, both economically and they had to spend the money to build up their defense systems to go against Putin, okay? This was done as the United States led with that. And I talk about a strong message to Putin. I don't think Putin had any idea that we'd ever be able to do what we did vis-a-vis that message. So if I'm Iran, interesting enough, I sit around and say to myself, guess they were pretty serious about fighting with Putin. That's interesting. They got the whole world basically against Putin. Now, maybe Biden is not so weak. Maybe this idea of the withdrawal in Afghanistan, it wasn't great in their view, but those big ships look like they could actually do us a lot of damage. So again, everyone interprets the way they want to interpret things, right? Those who want to interpret Afghanistan one way, they can. Those who want to interpret how we've organized NATO against Putin, that's another discussion. Maybe the Chinese look around and say, maybe we're not going to go take Taiwan, okay? Yeah. Given what America's done. So again, Margaret, it's hard to say which action creates what action, but I think right now, where we are today, I think no one should misconstrue Biden's focus on what he needs to do.
Benjamin Netanyahu was on the original firing line with William F. Buckley Jr. Take a look at what he said in 1986.
You can tell a lot about terrorists, but what happens when they come to power? Those who fight for freedom and come to power do not impose terrorism. Those who do, who fight in terroristic means, end up as being masters of terrorist states in Libya, in Algeria, and other countries that support and practice terrorism.
Hamas is elected democratically in 2006 to control Gaza. We know it happened. There hasn't been an election since 2006. It turned into essentially a terrorist state. Once Hamas is eradicated, what comes next?
Well, first of all, it's a great question, and I don't think anyone's yet to figure it out, okay? So I think ultimately what I think is important for people to understand, Hamas does not speak for Gazans. So I think that yes, he was. There are people who will say, well, he was elected 20 years ago.
And there was only, okay? That was the only election.
Okay, and to be clear, I've seen plenty of polls that show Hamas is deeply, deeply unpopular. And I would like them to take a poll of the people that are living in southern Gaza right now and ask them how appreciative are they of Hamas, how Hamas has improved their life, how has Hamas gotten them better healthcare and better opportunities, and see what they want to articulate how important Hamas has been to their life. Okay, so what comes after this? First of all, I think it's clear the Israelis cannot go occupy Gaza again. If they have to occupy for a short period of time for security, that's one thing. I think it's clear our position and the world's position that they're gonna need something else. It could be a Palestinian, it has to be include the other Arab nations, because first of all, it's gonna take billions and billions of dollars to basically rebuild Gaza City. So you're gonna have to get those monies from many of the Arab countries. So they're gonna have to come up with a plan here. You know, maybe the Palestinian Authority as currently constructed may or may not be strong enough to take over. But to be clear, the answer is not gonna be Israel occupying Gaza. And so I think there's a lot of people working on this. Mm-hmm. As my friend, Rahm Emanuel, who stole the line from Winston Churchill, of course he doesn't admit he stole the line from Winston Churchill, don't let a good crisis go to waste. We need to take this opportunity to try to reset not only for the Palestinian people, but for Gazans. And my hope is with the Saudis, because again, when I think about this, one of the reasons I was such a strong advocate for the Saudi normalization 2 months ago and 3 months ago and 6 months ago, was I think fundamentally it will change the dynamics in the region. And I don't want to give that hope up because Saudis can play an exceptionally important role here, not only for normalizing with the state of Israel, but getting Israel to do things for the Palestinian people that they're going to have to do. And I think that's going to be really important.
Hamas's political leadership is in Qatar.
Yes.
It has a branch in Lebanon. Supposedly some of their leaders are in Turkey. But if Israel dismantles Hamas in Gaza, how does it handle the political leadership abroad?
Well, I mean, again, the nexus of Hamas, the real power of Hamas lives in Gaza. Yes, there are political leaders who are hiding out in, or not even hiding out, are living in Qatar. That I think the power, the amount of rockets and military equipment all exists in Gaza. So I think they have to focus first on dismantling the threat, the actual threat, not the ideology. Listen, again, we learned this with ISIS. It'll take years to rid Gaza of the ideology of Hamas. And maybe that will never actually end as ISIS can continue to fight the ISIS ideology. But I think they can dismantle really the mechanism causing much of the harm of the state of Israel.
What gives you hope for the continued extension of the Abraham Accords to Saudi Arabia?
I spent a lot of time listening. Obviously, they were done not on my watch by a former administration. I was an enormous supporter of it. I spent a lot of time with the Emiratis and the Bahrainians and the Moroccans. It strengthens the region. It strengthens the security of the state of Israel. It's good for them. It's good for everyone. And I think ultimately, even during this very, very, very difficult time for these countries, which have Palestinian populations, they've basically have been, they've been critical, but they've not suggested they're going to break the normalization, right? They believe that was an important step towards long-term peace. Then think about this, the Saudis who are the biggest player in the region, the large, who have enormous impact with the rest of the Muslim world, Indonesia, Malaysia, Qatar, Kuwait. So my view of this is if we could get to a place, and I know now it's not the time because we're doing this with Hamas, but I really do fundamentally believe that a normalization with Saudi would not only help Israel, and then could potentially be the catalytic event that provides us the things to do we need for the Palestinian people. Because at the end of the day, one of the downsides of the Abraham Accords was the Palestinian people didn't get any benefits from it. Now, some of that was the Palestinians' fault. Some of this was that Netanyahu's, outside-in strategy. Whatever it was, we need to, on the next round, whatever that looks like, we got to be thinking carefully and closely about the fate of the Palestinian people, to focus on a two-state solution, to focus on the future of the Palestinians, because I think it's not only right for security, but it's just the right thing to do. And so that's why I cared so much and why I got so involved in it, because I think it's the right thing to do and spend a lot of time. I went to Hussein Sheikh's house during Ramadan, which of course I didn't tell anyone in my State Department. Oops, now I'm telling people. Doing as ambassador with actually Bibi's national security advisor. We both went together.
A prominent Palestinian politician on the West Bank.
To break fast. And this is what we need to be doing, right? We need to get back to some normal rhythm here. We need to get, these people want just the same thing we want. And when people hear, Hamas, again, they don't speak for the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people, by and large, want the same thing as most Israelis do. They just want an opportunity, they want a job, they want to do the right thing, and we've got to figure out a way to get there.
Have you spoken to your successor, Jack Lew, since he took the job?
Many times.
Should the embassy remain in Jerusalem?
Yes. It's the capital of Israel.
Back in February, long before this chapter, you expressed concern that Israel is losing the narrative on college campuses. We have seen an explosion of now overt anti-Semitism on college campuses. What can be done? By the way, this is a global phenomenon, but on American college campuses, from the 18 to 24-year-olds, what can be done to combat this?
Well, you are right. I've been on this since the moment I got to Israel. You know, people talk about, oh, you know, they're worried about the AOCs of the world. Forget it. That's ridiculous. AOC, she should and can say whatever she wants to say. That's her right to do that. My view was, let's not focus on some members of Congress to say things that we don't particularly like. Okay, we'll put that aside, okay? We need to be worrying about the next generation, okay? And college kids, my kids, you know, they're always for the perceived underdog. That's just the reality. And I said in every speech, I am pro-Israel and pro the Palestinian people. Yeah. You can do both. And we have to get the language right. People need to understand that you have to choose between the two. Now, if they cross the line and people are talking about, you know, the river to the sea, then I'm more than happy to, you know, to do what we need to do to rid that
a language. Term that represents the annihilation of Israel.
Yeah, totally. That's just bigotry. That's ignorance and bigotry. But I have no issues with if college kids want to talk about the cause of the Palestinian people and what they're fighting for and what they need to get. Mm-hmm. I'm all good. I feel that that's totally okay. And I think we need to do a better job of telling those kids it's okay. Now, like everything else, there's a fine line between talking about something that you care deeply about and making sure you have been given the information to understand it. When I tell these kids, I said, you know, Hamas doesn't represent the Palestinian people. They go, what do you mean? They were voted on. Yeah, 20 years ago. And when I say that Hamas doesn't let women leave the house, there's no gay rights, there's no rights whatsoever, that they run everything in the media, the hospitals, everything. They're like, you're kidding me. I said, no. So I think ultimately, we have to spend time on college camps. We have to educate. We need to have a moonshot program. We need to really spend a lot of time and energy to try to figure out what moves these kids. Listen, Israel isn't perfect, to be clear, and they need to do a better job of communicating. Israel is a melting pot. There's 9 million people who live in Israel. You know, 2 million of those are Arabs. I mean, it's not like people don't understand that. They're, what are you talking about? I didn't know they live... Yeah. Side by side, Arabs and Jews live side by side in Israel all day long. Everything, you know, and again, it's never perfect. By the way, it's not perfect here in the United States of America, just to remind people, but it's not perfect. So I just think I believe in my heart, we got to do a better job of talking to my kids and, you know, other people's kids and college campuses and make sure they understand the story of Israel, the importance of this, why Israel was even created, and also talk about the importance of taking care of the Palestinian people. I'm all in.
Ambassador Tom Nides, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.